This meeting is now being recorded.
That wasn't my voice. That was another voice announcing that we are now public. This meeting is being recorded. My name is John Conklin. I'm the chair of the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee. I want to welcome everybody. We're about to take roll call, but I want to sort of set the flavor, if not the tone of the day, in the sense of this is a very active and vibrant committee that typically has a 90 to close to 100% attendance in the room. And due to incoming storms, and completely understandable that a majority of folks have the common sense to stay on the phone, not that those folks in the room don't have common sense. I was discussing with Zlatko yesterday how we're going to describe those in the room, and it went from the Elite Eight to the Magnificent Seven to the Superb Six to now the Fabulous Five. So there are five committee members in the room. So those of you on the phone, the only reason I say that is so that you all understand for discussion purposes today, we're going to do our best to make sure everybody is heard, but obviously we will not see hands raised nor attempts to speak from those of you on the phone. So please, not that it's my experience you are shy, but please don't be shy. I want this meeting to be like any other meeting where we're all in the room, where everybody has a chance to be heard. There's some, though a rather abbreviated agenda today, I think there's some obviously important discussion items. So with that and that welcome, I'm going to ask Brandy to take roll call. I would ask, we're going to take a roll call down the list. And so for those of you on the phone, if you could do your best to speak up so we know you're on the phone. I've been on these same meetings, so I know you're going to mute us right away and do other things, but please listen in as well. Be careful not to put us on hold. I'm just, as I tell everybody, if you put us on hold, we can't do anything. So appreciate that. Thank you all very much for your participation, and we'll have Brandy take roll call.
Judge Conklin.
Present.
Judge Barton.
Here.
Judge Blum.
Here.
Judge Cope. Here. Judge Earl.
I'm here on the phone.
Thank you. And Judge Herman. Running a bit late from what I understand. Judge Heinrich? Judge Johnson?
Here.
Judge Kaufman?
Here.
Judge Cole? Judge Marigonda?
Here by phone.
Thank you. Judge McCain?
Here by phone.
Judge Sanders?
Here telephonically.
Thank you. Ms. Carter?
Right.
Here. Mr. Chatters?
Here.
Ms. Fleming?
Here.
Mr. Hamrick? Mr. Harrigan?
Here.
Mr. Lewis? Mr. Planet?
He's on his way. Plane is landing.
Mr. Roddy?
Here.
Ms. Romero-Souls?
Here by phone.
Mr. Taylor? Ms. Ugrin Capobianco?
Here by phone.
And Mr. Yamasaki.
Here by phone.
Great, thank you. And I'd like to do roll call for the advisory members as well. Ms. Patel? Ms. Tidwell? Mr. Wardlaw?
Present.
And Mr. Theodorovich?
Present.
Thank you.
And should we identify the staff that are here as well in support of the meeting?
Oh, sure, why not? I'll start with me, Brandy Sanborn, Budget Services Manager.
Patrick Ballard. Budget Services Supervisor.
Suzanne Blahevdy, Fiscal Analyst.
Natalie Daniel, Budget Services Supervisor.
Cottrell Wood, Senior Fiscal Analyst.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. I trust everybody has the materials that have been distributed and were sent out over the past few days. We'll be referring to those during the course of the meeting. And I'm now going to ask for a motion for approval of the minutes from the December 12th meeting. That was a telephonic rather than an in-person meeting. It's on page 3 of your meeting materials. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
I'll move. This is Tanya.
So I'm going to interpret Tanya's as a second and Judge Cope's as a motion. So the motion has been moved and seconded to approve the minutes of the December 12th meeting. Is there any opposition to the motion to approve the minutes? Hearing none, then I will interpret the silence as a unanimous approval of the minutes of the December 12th meeting. Minutes are approved. been informed that there was no public comment received prior to the meeting, and I just through the power of observation have seen nobody in the audience except for obviously staff, so I'm inferring from that there's no public comment today, and therefore...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
This is Sherry Carter. Just to
clarify,
I thought we might want to have it on the record that I do have Judge Kuhl's proxy vote so that when I vote, the staff would know that I'm voting for Judge Kuhl as well.
You do have it. Thank you for reminding me. I spoke to Judge Kuhl personally yesterday evening, and she, for the same limitation many of you have, was unable to travel, as was Sherry, and therefore Judge Kuhl, and I have the email from Judge Kuhl, I'll show that to staff, so it's clear that that was Judge Kuhl's proxy to Sherry, but that is a proxy, so we have Judge Kuhl by proxy. Okay? All right. So that concludes public comment. And we're now going to move to discussion items from the agenda, the first being the governor's budget proposal. I know many of you have heard this and are familiar with it, but I felt it was appropriate, and sometimes repetition is one of the best ways to both remember and understand, and Zlatko is the master of repetition. So with that, I'm going to ask him to, and any comments on his presentation are welcome. Zlatko?
Yeah, thank you, Judge Conklin. I appreciate that. Except for the repetition part, but we're all right. We're good friends. So, yes, the package does include the memo that we sent out upon the release of the budget. It includes the relevant sections of the budget summary that identify the statements made by the governor regarding our budget and some of the, as they see it, the highlights of the proposal. I think as we had phone calls the day after the budget was released, we had approximately at least over 200 people, or at least phone calls in on those calls, and so we were very glad to hear that there was that active participation. Certainly there were probably many more folks in the rooms when the phone calls were happening. But as Judge Conklin has said, hearing the message now almost a full month later to give you any updates as far as what's transpired since then would be helpful, I think, for all of us to understand as we deliberate on the next budget process. The budget, as proposed by the governor, reflects a softening in revenues. Not that the revenues are declining and going down, but rather lower increasing revenue projections than were anticipated when the budget was passed in June. There's also been issues with other expenditures, significant expenditure issues, namely in the Medi-Cal area, that have put a pressure on the budget, and therefore there was a proposed need to adjust expenditures and look at options to solve what was viewed as a budget hole in the budget. And so with that and this governor being fairly cautious about how he builds his budgets and not wanting to create structural problems, there were spending reductions, but sort of from our branch perspective, not the kinds of growth that we had seen over the last few years. In fact, no new discretionary funding, only some limited, but also important investments, say, in technology that were included in the budget. So in terms of where we are, there's a fairly substantial proposal that doesn't have a dollar amount reflected in it, but it's an important issue for us is the repeal of the driver's license holds and the implications on the ability to suspend those driver's licenses. We are working with court executives to gather the kinds of information necessary to demonstrate that that tool being lost will have an impact. But we're sort of separating the discussion of the policy discussion of the tool and its merits versus the fiscal impact. And we think that's an important distinction to be made as we go forward about the policy versus the fiscal. Important for us was maintaining the revenue backfill for the Tracker Trust Fund, as we've had some, as you know, revenues throughout the branch have been down as we have a reduced participation in the branch, be it in the civil arena and also, say, in the traffic arena where revenues are down. As far as our – yes?
You, on the driver's license suspension issue, I don't know, is it too early even to have any rough numbers of what that would be?
From a statewide perspective, yes, because we're seeing that there's varying implementation and use of the tool, and therefore depending on how aggressive individual courts are, I think what we can say safely is that there is an impact. which was, in contrast to the suggestion that there isn't. So we're putting ourselves on that side. Now it's a matter of the scope and breadth. And that is the challenge because, again, depending on the aggressiveness and the use of the tool, clearly has an impact on what you see as the loss. Courts are in different places as far as the aggressiveness of the use of that and how they implement their collections programs.
Any idea how soon we'd have some data?
We have individual court data, but ensuring that they make sense. In some cases, there were courts who put on a moratorium on using a holds, ensuring that that data has been scrubbed and that we aren't accounting for. Problem is that this was all done during the period of amnesty, and so how do you differentiate an amnesty impact against the tool and it's being pulled back? As these courts reinstate that tool, we might be able to see, because amnesty will still be in for a few more months, what is the real impact on collections. But I know folks who have sophisticated collections programs are able to try and tease out some of that information, but it is definitely something. And our interest is in providing solid, justifiable information we can stand behind. And so rushing to throw out a number that we may need to adjust, I think it could be more harm than good, but just that we acknowledge that there is an impact and we've committed to get that data. Budget hearings won't start until March, and so I know the time is short, but we know we have brains thinking about it and gathering data, and you can see some folks have very sophisticated reporting tools, dashboards that show them various pieces of information. We just need to make sure we can pull it together and provide a good, solid, digestible reaction to the governor's proposal.
And the hope is, I guess, from my perspective, for what it's worth, is policy might not be our bailiwick on this. The policy might be up to the legislature behind this. But I would hope that information we can provide to the Department of Finance and others about the impact of the decision will help them carefully reflect upon policy. But maybe I'm being – well, never mind. I hope that would be useful information.
So I'm not going to go through any more details on the memo, but I'll talk to you about what's happened since the release is that we've had multiple questions from the legislative analyst about the proposed budget and in particular about the driver's license holds. We, through the good work of Jake and SEAC, were able to put out to all the courts a survey to gather information. We're calling through that with them. To make sure that we're again getting good information for them, but the LAO is going to be, I think, a voice in this issue, and we hope that we can get some level of in unison with them, because I think their original admission and the immediate reaction was there is going to be a loss. So it's important that we get the kind of information to the LAO, who's spent a lot of time learning about our collections program, the kind of information that so we can have support. So we're not the only voice when come a budget hearing about this and sort of rebuttal to the administration's proposal. I think today, even it just started about 20 minutes ago, was a budget overview in the Senate. There was an overview in the Assembly. There was only one mention in the Assembly budget overview about dependency council. I think, as I reported when the budget was signed last year, that it was one of the few specific identified problems that some of the members had with the budget was that at the last second, dependency council was pulled out of that budget. $29 million that had been set aside in the legislature's budget, but when it came down to executing the final budget, maybe I'll take a moment and recognize Judge Herman's arrival. We're glad to see that you've made it safe. I don't know how sound.
I canceled and my flight back is canceled, so I may have to jump out and deal with it.
No problem. Yeah.
You want me to fly through L.A. getting home at 2, so.
To this afternoon or to this morning?
Afternoon. About 10:50 flight this evening, so.
Oh. So we have work to do. It's important that we do get a solid, justified, supportable message out to the legislature and back to the administration regarding their proposal. And we look forward to your support, which you've always provided, and we've been appreciative of that. So we apologize in advance that there'll be more questions, more surveys, but we think it's critical as we're adjusting to the proposals and the reactions in the legislature regarding the the governor's proposal. And so I think with that, are there any questions from the folks on the phone about the budget that we could try to help with at this moment?
So I'll just chime in a little bit. I've moved to another part of the room, but I recognize there was, as Locke said, 200 people on the phone call before. This is a public phone call as well. We're being recorded, but now we're a more finite group of obviously TICPAC members. So any concerns, questions you have of Zlotko or others about the budget, this might be a more effective way to talk about that if anybody has them. So I'm just trying to encourage questions if there are any or thoughts generally as we move through.
Judge Coughlin, this is Jake Chatters. So I guess maybe a question about how we want to go through today. I know we're talking about fiscal year 18-19 BCPs and on a later item. So do you want to sort of talk now about questions or ideas about how we're moving forward on advocacy for 17-18, or do you want to kind of handle that as part of the BCP discussion, even though that's looking further forward at 18-19?
You know, I think it'd probably be more effective and efficient to handle them all in the same discussion. So we're going to get through the children's waiting room discussion. But Jake, I think your approach is a good one. As once we start it, as just an overall strategy of 17-18, both from budget and BCP perspective, is a good one. So to answer your question directly, let's wait till after children's waiting room to do that.
Okay.
But I think we all recognize that's the sort of going to be the meat of this meeting, pardon the pun, is the BCP discussion. That's why I'm so glad everybody's on the room and on the phone. And with that, any more questions for Zlotko about budget, any concerns at all in general about where we're going? I know it's early in the process. Okay, I've waited, I've paused, I see no hands. So we're now moving on to the children's waiting room policy, item number 2. This is an action item. Suzanne's in the room with us, present, and I'm going to ask Suzanne to both introduce briefly that you have a summary of the children's waiting room distribution and fund balance policy. And I'm over generalizing, and I'll let Suzanne go in deeper, but we have a decision to make today about an annual versus a biennial, which is every 2 years rather than every 6 months. Decision on that. With that, Suzanne?
With that, this is Suzanne Wilhazi. So I just want to give a brief history, but as I'm looking at it, my brief history is probably as long as my agenda item, but it's got a little bit more detail. Government Code 7640 is what gives the Judicial Council the authority to collect or have the courts do a filing fee surcharge. Prior to that, the counties had the authorization, and the surcharge was between no less than $2 and no greater than $5 for children's waiting rooms. When GC 7640 went into effect January 1st, 2006, it authorized the Judicial Council to approve a court's request for new filing fee surcharges for children's waiting room and to approve requests for adjustments to the current fee surcharges, which remained within the $2 to $5 range. It also stated that the Judicial Council could set policy and procedures for the administration of the children's waiting room program. Additionally, this section allowed for the fund balances which the counties had collected to be transferred to the Judicial Council. Between January 1, 2006 and the first approved CWR policy, administration of CWR fell under the standard of 10.24 of the Standards of Judicial Administration, which is included in the agenda item. The first CWR policy was adopted by the Judicial Council on June 27, 2014. This policy outlined procedures for requesting new fee disbursement for CWR activities, specifically stating timeframes for submitting requests, as well as detailing what information needed to be included with the request. There were other items that were considered to be included in the new policy, such as requiring an annual budget for staffing and other expenditures to operate a CWR, requiring a description of the supervision of the CWR that the court intended to provide, and requiring that the court acknowledge that it would not spend its distribution on capital outlay, which is prohibited under Section 7640C. These recommendations were ultimately not included in the CWR policy. The next revision of the CWR policy was approved by the Council on December 12, 2014. Based on the recommendations of a working group, this revision allowed courts under specific circumstances to request to collect the CWR fee surcharge a year prior to the opening of its waiting room. In addition, the process was amended to specify that once a court's request to decrease its existing CWR distribution as approved by the Judicial Council, the request can be implemented by staff effective either January 1st or July 1st. The most recent revision approved by the Council on June 26, 2015, set a cap on the maximum amount of CWR funds the court can accumulate based on the highest disbursement level over the past three fiscal years. Any excess of funds over the cap would be returned to the PCTF as unrestricted funds. This revision also established a procedure for a court wanting a cap adjustment to submit a request explaining the extenuating circumstances. The request would need to include the court's CWR expenditure plan for consideration by the TICFAC and the Judicial Council. In October 2016, three courts were approved for an exemption to the cap to address multi-year contracts and projected expenditures requiring funds in excess of the cap. When these exemptions were approved, the recommendation was approved for TICFAC to revisit the current CWR policy. Options for your consideration and discussion today are: Option 1, the TICFAC would not make any recommendations for policy change at this time and continue annual review and adjustment of the CWR fund balances, as this policy revision is in its second fiscal year of implementation. This option would possibly impact multi-year contracts through a reduced cap adjustment that may result in less funds for courts to cover contracts they plan to have funding for. Option 2, the TICFAC could extend the review and adjustment of CWR fund balances to a biennial schedule or to a schedule mirroring the number of years of a multi-year contract, allowing courts the opportunity to better plan with a set fund balance cap spanning two or more years. This option could lengthen the time of potential CWR fund balances that exceed the cap to be returned to the PCTF to support trial court operation allocations. In addition, there could be tracking challenges in the event of the annual review is lifted and the policy recommendation to mirror that of an individual multi-year contract. A third option was provided via email from the Chief Executive Officer of Superior Court of Santa Barbara, and that recommendation was that if an exemption to the cap was approved, this option would require an annual report on the status of the court's children's waiting room operations to ensure that the money is still being used appropriately, or report of any changes to the operational expenditures. In this manner, the court can engage in multiple contracts, and the committee can be assured that the revenues are being used appropriately in each subsequent year. If a court's circumstances change, the committee would have an opportunity each year to reconsider the authorization without interfering with the court's contractual operation in those instances where no change is reported.
Okay, thank you very much. Those are the options laid out. Judge Herman is in the room, but is on a work call. I know he wants to be heard on this as well. I'll give him the opportunity to do that, but obviously any comments or questions at this point for either those on the phone or in the room?
Judge Conklin, this is David Yamasaki, if I could, when it's appropriate.
It is now.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the presentation. I was one of the individuals that participated in the establishment of the new process as it relates to the Children's Waiting Room Funds, and I think the actions that were taken realigned the underlying purpose for the use of the money and ensured that there was appropriate funding left for each court to sustain its operations. And as all of you know, the funds that are held there are highly restricted in terms of only being able to be used for that sole purpose. So that resulted in a significant shift of resources from the local accounts to the TCTF. So a lot of progress was made, and really, appropriately adjusting what the operational costs were with the amount of money that was held. So that is just kind of the groundwork of what I wanted to say. And I think that having been using the system for a couple of years, it seems to be working very well. We've been very active in reviewing the proposals to extend or retain some of the monies for this purpose. And everything is completely supported by documentation. Each of the courts that presented information. I do believe, given our experience with the requests that have come in and the necessity of courts to have more flexibility to support the long-term contracts, the multi-year contracts that most of us all have in the area of the children's waiting room, I think option number two is one that helps the courts function with greater flexibility, and I would move approval of the second option contained in the proposal.
I would second.
All right, Judge Herman has seconded. Mr. Yamasaki has moved. So, David, just I'm just asking as a matter of perspective, and clearly you have done a lot of work on this, but related to option one, and recognizing that we've only been now in this process for about a year and a half, is it your perspective that we're far enough down the line to have information to confidently conclude that a multi-year approach rather than a single-year approach would be appropriate? In other words, the other side would be, do we just march on as we have, look at this a year from now when we have a little more history behind us to make the final determination as to whether or not we should go to a multi-year approach?
I think we have enough information. We reviewed many requests since that time, and each of the courts provided sufficient documentation to seek an extension. We all very much understand the limitations on the use of the funds. We've never seen any issues where the funds were used for any other purpose than it was originally intended. It's an administrative efficiency, in my view, extended to a biennial review process, and all of us are obviously subject to regular audits, and I don't know of any occasion where a question was raised in the time that I've been familiar with this topic.
So what of the, and it's presented as option three.
It was a email that was received.
Right. So I'm wondering if it would either be an option three or a friendly amendment that if, in fact, we approve option two, it would require that the courts essentially, and I'm probably here I have, that the committee would consider authorizing the cap requested and require an annual report on the status of the children's waiting room to ensure the money's still being used. So we go with option, if option two is approved, this would be an amendment to that that would require that there be an annual report submitted by those courts with multi-year contracts back to this committee, essentially to monitor. Sherry?
Yeah, this is Sherry. Oh, thank you. It's scary that you knew my voice, Judge Conklin. I must get in trouble a lot with you. I would support your amendment to option two. I think that is really wise because we don't need funds to build up in these accounts that would otherwise be spread to the trial court trust fund, especially since they're restricted funds in the first place. And so I would support David's motion for option two with your friendly amendment if the motion and the second would agree.
This is David. I support that friendly amendment.
Judge Herman?
I would likewise support.
Okay. So does staff in the room have what they need to understand now, the motion with the amendment?
Let me repeat it to make sure. So it's option two with the friendly amendment that if a cap is approved or extension modification of the cap is approved, that if they're for multi-year contracts, that they have to report, just submit a report on an annual basis in between.
Yes.
The multi-year contract. But yeah, I have it.
All right. Discussions, questions, concerns?
Well, so I would just say that when they submit the report, if you see the projected buildup of the account is growing significantly faster than the requirements, and of course, Zlatko, your staff would need to do something.
Absolutely.
Okay, that was it. Okay, thank you.
Well, and Chair, you make a good point that the report would not simply be an absent action. It would have impact if the report is received back and it's determined that there is a significant buildup, that staff would then make that recommendation or request that those funds.
And I would think inherent in the motion would be an understanding that staff would develop a form that everybody could uniformly be reporting, so that it could be then reported consistently. And to the extent we see there's any growth, then we just return this issue to the council or to the court and advise them of that and ask if there's any changes needed to the cap, and re-engage the discussion with the committee.
And I think that enhanced, Judge Herman?
Yeah, I would just add, I mean, I supported it by way of second, but, you know, there's two pieces to this. One piece is, you know, again, the need for us to deal with our vendors on a where we have longer-term contracts. But the second piece is just the impact on the trial courts in terms of reporting, et cetera, the administrative overhead. So I would urge if we go in this direction and do develop a form that we make it fairly simple, so it's just merely a check-in. And I think the reason that that makes some sense is, you know, really even with a two-year span, the accountability, I mean, we would be, if a court were to jiggle around with the figures, there would be a clawback. So I think we're in pretty safe ground if we kind of keep it simple and then have biannual reporting that's more robust, yeah. Just a thought.
And so I'd add is that our whatever form we develop, we would make sure we road test it, so to speak, to make sure that it's acceptable for folks. And it gathers the information that's absolutely necessary.
And I think the other, and maybe I'm repeating what was already said, but Judge Herman described as two concerns. I think the third would be transparency. And we recognize that any time we deal with numbers and budget in a court, we need to have both actual and apparent transparency of that budget, and this accomplishes that by saying to those courts every year a report's been. I agree with you, Judge Herman. I think a very simple form can be set forth, but we now can show to those that are looking at from the outside how this money is used. It's being used responsibly and with transparency.
Jim Herman agreed.
Okay. So just again, and I know I'm drilling down a little bit, but I want to make sure we all have the same understanding, because option two talks about extend, and I'm just reading from it, the CWR fund balances to a biennial schedule or to a schedule mirroring the number of years of the multi-year contract. So if a court has more than a two-year contract, this would allow them to maintain that contract, biennial being two, as I just learned, and others, but still having to submit the report. Is that everybody's understanding?
Well, actually, it's good you clarified that biannual is every 2 years, because it can also mean twice a year.
It has a spelling difference.
I thought that was semiannual. Twice a year is semiannual, right?
I had thought that.
Jim Herman.
But anyway.
So
Jim Herman coping with definitions.
So. So we all understand that this that as set forth in the motion, biennial is every two years.
Every 2 years, okay.
Right.
So, Judge Conklin, this is Jake Chatters again, sorry.
Go ahead.
So, I guess I'll provide a little. I am not real comfortable with having an or. I think that that leads to different accounting and different reporting across the different trial courts. And while I'm a little hesitant to really support a biannual review after we've only had this in place 1 year, just as I was skeptical of kind of the changes were sort of made in the process of approving the fund balance caps this past year, I think having an or is problematic. I think if we're going to do one, a biannual schedule that says something like they will be reviewed biannually in odd-numbered years, since these would all be subject to review this coming year anyway, since the action last year was a one-year exception to the cap, I think that gives some certainty. It gives some consistency in when it's being reported. And since we are talking about fund balances and not ongoing revenue, hopefully contracts are not long-term contracts relying on one-time money. So, anyway, that would be my comment. I wouldn't be supportive of one that has an or that creates a different way of accounting for it for different trial courts. But as reticent as I may be, I could be supportive of a biennial, like every other year. Sorry.
Yeah. Judge Conklin, this is David, and I concur. Just having a set schedule that everybody needs to follow, I think it's reliable, just to avoid any discrepancies from court to court. And my whole idea was trying to simplify the process, but also make sure that courts need to provide the information to justify the retention of some of those monies for multi-year contracts. I concur Jake on the exclusion of the word or. It doesn't eliminate it, but it simply makes it a little more, aligned with a particular schedule for everyone to follow.
So, David, I'm looking at the options, and again, I just want to make sure, because this is an action item and staff will be in the room to prepare the final, but is it your, since you made the motion, the clause on the second line of option two beginning or, and the clause reading or to schedule mirroring the number of years of a multi-year contract, just to remove that clause? So it would read the tickback could, it would read extend the review and adjustment of CWR fund balances to a biennial schedule, allowing courts the opportunity to better plan with a set fund balance cap, and then the rest would remain the same, and with an annual reporting process to be developed by staff.
That's exactly what I had in mind, so thank you for the clarification.
So as we've now moved through this, Judge Herman, are you, is your second still in place?
Yes.
Okay. With that, any further discussions, concerns, or questions? All right, then I'm going to call, and we're just, this is an action item, but we don't have hands in the room, so I'm just going to ask for a roll call on this, simply because I think that's necessary to make sure that we have the appropriate votes.
Okay, Judge Conklin.
Approve.
Judge Barton.
Approve.
Judge Blum.
Approve.
Judge Earl.
Approve, and just with one caveat, I have to run in to do a court hearing. I'll be back, but I will give Judge Conklin my proxy if you get to item three.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, and Judge Cope?
Approve.
Judge Herman?
Approve.
Judge Heinrichs?
Approve.
Judge Johnson?
Yes.
Judge Kaufman?
Approve.
Judge Cole? Absent. Judge Maragonda?
Approve.
Thank you. Judge McCabe?
Approve.
Judge Sanders?
I have
Judge Carter. Excuse me.
Judge Saunders, proxy. This is David.
Thank you. And Mr. Yamasaki, is that a yes?
Yes.
Oh, great. And for yourself as well?
Yes.
Thank you. Ms. Carter?
Approve.
And you're approving for Judge Kuhl as well?
Right.
Thank you. Mr. Chatters?
Yes.
Ms. Fleming?
Approve.
Mr. Hamrick?
Approve.
Mr. Harrigan?
Approve.
Mr. Lewis? Mr. Planet? Still traveling, I believe. Mr. Roddy?
Approve.
Ms. Romero-Soles?
Approved.
Mr. Taylor? Mr. Taylor again? Nope. Ms. Ugrin-Capobianco?
Approved.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
All right, is there anybody that has not had the opportunity to vote? All right, it does appear it passes unanimously as amended. So thank you all very much for that. We are now moving to item three on the agenda, which is likewise an action item. And this is prioritization of the trial court budget change proposals for 2018-2019. I'm going to turn this over to Zlatko in just a moment to give us a little bit of a background about how these BCPs have been received and impact in the past, I guess, is the best way to put it. I would look forward to a very candid and vibrant discussion on this issue, recognizing how important it is to both, well, to the trial courts from our perspective. So I know there's a lot of people on the phone. I want to get everybody a chance to be heard. As I said, I'm going to turn it over to Zlatko, but I guess, as chair, I'll just start off with my perspective, and that is it hasn't worked in the past, the approach. And I'm hoping that maybe we can have a discussion today about maybe a more effective way to present BCPs and candidly, perhaps we try to limit the BCPs to those that are most impactful to us, recognizing every one of these is important. But I think if maybe we come up with fewer, more refined BCPs, that might send more of a message than, as we have in years past, sending 8, 10, or 12 BCPs. But I'm going to turn it over to Zlatko to help us understand how it's worked in the past and where we're going.
Thank you, Judge Conklin. Just wanted to sort of go through the list and remind folks of our prior efforts and their results. While some have been successful, in many cases, the reaction in the budget was not as favorable as we had hoped in what we had submitted. So, for example, and the lists, I'm going to go through both Table 1 and Table 2. just so you understand the concept. And in the presentation of Table 1, as it's identified, it's in alphabetical order, so it does not represent a hierarchy of votes or anything like that, just presenting it for the purpose of discussion. So civil assessment revenues were requested of the Department of Finance this most recent spring, given the impact of amnesty. We had identified that shortfall in the fall budget process, and then when we had our refined numbers and had more time away from the beginning of amnesty, we could see where we were going. We did present that as part of our overall trial court trust fund backfill request. And unfortunately, I think as we reported when the May revision came, that was not backfilled by the administration. And at that time, the Director of Finance, taking a similar stance on when we very first submitted our backfill for trial court trust fund issues, had identified this policy that anything considered local revenues were not going to be subject to backfill, only those that were funding your trial court-based allocations. So that was the rationale then. I think to the extent that this is something that's pursued, we need to examine what is considered revenue supporting trial court operations and make probably a more robust discussion about the value of civil assessments and any other revenues that are part of the system and what they mean to your operations. Taking a narrow view with what the Department of Finance had done, it's probably an approach we should think about is how do we adjust that. Court-appointed dependency counsel, as you know, has been a priority in the past and currently of the administration, of the judicial counsel and the branch. It has been requested twice of the Department of Finance, and they've rejected it each time. We know that $11 million was included in the 15-16 budget as new money which the governor did keep in. It was added by the legislature. And I think I'd mentioned when we were talking about the budget, the $29 million that was initially sort of contemplated by the legislature, but not ultimately in the final budget. Again, a worthy ask, but is there an alternative approach to make something more palatable to the decision makers and the funding decisions? The third item is the discretionary funding allocated via WAFM. As you know, we have been requesting this since the development of WAFM, and while I would use the term rejected our request, I'm characterizing the fact that while we did get new money, $60 million, $86 million, $90 million, and $20 million, of which we ultimately allocated via WAFM, it wasn't, from our perspective, an affirmation of the WAFM need from their perspective. It was just a matter of a provision of additional resources. And so I think one of our continued struggles, again, is WAFM compelling to the administration as the basis of a funding need? Again, I put that out there as, in all honesty, about, you know, our feedback and our awareness. In fact, it's been, as testified by a legislative analyst this last year, in opposition to the $20 million that they yet to agree on the fiscal aspect of WAFM, that they do support the distribution aspect of WAFM and how it aligns revenues and allocations with workload. So again, do we need to think about how we approach this? Discretionary funding, we did submit our BCP this fall to the Department of Finance regarding a cost of living CPI price of inflation for overall trial court operations separate apart from WAFM. That was not included in this most recent budget. Trial court employee compensation, in some form or fashion, has been requested individually to the Department of Finance the last three fiscal years, 15-16, 16-17, 17-18. At this point, we hear that they've provided discretionary funding and to what extent that covers any of the trial court's needs, including employee compensation. We understand the challenges that individual courts may have given the interaction with WAFM and what it's doing to their allocations. But again, just pointing out our repeated efforts to fund this and what may be an alternative strategy that might be considered as far as funding core trial court operations costs. And finally is an item.
Chair, may I ask a question? Sure, of course.
I was just number five. Does that include benefits?
Benefits are separately funded, and I think there's an item down below on the list, number four, that I'll get to. I hear somebody on the line, maybe? Identified here was the base operations revenue backfill that has been, depending on what your definition of is of base operations revenues, and again, that I think that speaks to number one, which is there currently is for your base allocations revenue backfill. The current budget includes $55 million to keep folks whole, acknowledging to the group that the very first year we requested it, the Department of Finance did not recognize 22.7 of our shortfall, and therefore that was an adjustment to your overall distribution of new money that was offset by that. So, but since that point, there's been an acknowledgement of that. Again, it might be an issue of what do we look as far as overall funding strategy for the branch and the interplay of our revenues that fund us and the general fund, and what is that mix? And there's been some thought about maybe looking at that state-local tri-court relationship again and what funds are deposited where and how they're managed and what options there are to provide greater stability. So speak to that as far as there is a process, but if a discussion is more broad, then I think it's worthy of talking about a strategy as to sort of base tri-court revenue support. Going on to Table 2, case management system enhancements. Administration has been supportive of this. They included the CCM, the V3 money this year, and proposing for next year a sustained justice addition funding. So we've seen some successes there. Construction of new facilities been submitted twice to the Department of Finance with no support at this juncture. Looking for a legislative support to try and get that funding there, but at this point. Neither of the last two budgets have included any new money for addressing our shortfalls in our construction programs. Number three was data security. And the second group represents items that had one or two votes. Everything else had three or more votes, so to speak, above. So just to understand why there's a distinction in the lists. So, again, we've talked about technology, case management systems. That might be something that could be explored given the willingness and openness of the administration to look at technology. In terms of employee benefit cost increases, this is a nuanced issue, but it's still important, is that I believe the question being asked here is we have benefit increases that occur mid-year, and the funding process only provides for money for those costs in the budget year. So trial courts are having to absorb the mid-year cost increases. And so while there may be this demonstration of new money in the budget, when you have an unfunded current year cost, it makes it difficult to argue that you can get much program enhancement when you're having to cover these costs. And I think what has been a particular concern is that as retirement systems locally are looking at adjusting their discount rate, what they assume their returns will be on their plans, and they've been ratcheting those down, that means that it's going to be a greater contribution and therefore a greater hit in the current year. So I don't know if, Sam, that's what your concern has been. So there is a process, but it's slightly broken from our perspective, and we have raised that to the Department of Finance staff to bring sort of parity with the process that state agencies get funded with. And you know that staff did bring that to their executive office this last budget cycle, and it was not supported as they had an existing process that they have had in place with us, notwithstanding the fact that it does cost us money in the current year that's not funded. Funding for new mandates, we always submit budget change proposals for new legislation and any impact from any voter passed initiatives. It's been a hit and miss with that, and unfortunately this most recent year, and given the assumptions of revenues and costs that the Department of Finance had presented to the governor, not seeing the ability to fund additional costs for new mandates, effectively is saying find a way to manage this workload, and if backlogs develop, then that's the issue. But again, we always ask and it's been only on some of the more recent propositions like Prop 47 and then AB 109 and criminal justice realignment issues where we've gotten some funding. So it's been very narrow in their response budgetarily. Number six, e-service infrastructure, again, falls into the technology. Might be an area that could be explored. Maintenance of existing facilities, I think, has been submitted almost every year that I've been here, and they've not provided us any funding. That's unfortunate because we do have exhaustion of our funds that are available for this area, and yet we have ever-growing needs, especially as we're not building new facilities. Remaining on our existing facilities becomes an increasing cost to us. We know that we were at the point where we're doing emergency repairs as opposed to routine maintenance to keep things moving forward. New judgeships has again been an issue where we requested it on multiple occasions and it's been rejected. The reaction of the administration, as you know, has been to look at reallocating existing judgeships. But again, the idea of new funding for new judgeships has not been supported by the Department of Finance. Security equipment has been part of our requests for existing maintenance facilities and any equipment necessary to maintain them has not been approved by the Department of Finance. Self-help was one of the items. It's not been requested by us to the administration, so I won't know necessarily what their reaction would be to that. Obviously, that's an important program for the trial courts and the folks who come to us. But again, we don't have any history in terms of what their reaction might be to that. And then finally, the $48 million maintenance of effort buyout, an important issue, clearly, as far as the value to the overall support of the trial court trust fund and the fact that you have a limited number of courts contributing some of their civil assessment collections to support all of the trial courts. This was requested and rejected by the Department of Finance as part of the building of the budget that was proposed. So, again, this is not to stymie the discussion, but rather to inform and hopefully get us in a direction in recognizing what has been the reaction of the administration as we submit BCPs. And this seems to dovetail to what is our reaction to the governor's proposed budget that Jake raised and what we might think about as far as current advocacy for the legislative process as we go through to June and how this might set us up for what we submit to the Department of Finance ultimately through the council in September.
Okay, so just to start the discussion, and by no means to dictate the discussion, but I think you all can see we're taking a little different approach on this year, in the sense of in the past staff has initially provided a hierarchy of BCPs, for lack of a better description, if not a recommendation, and this year talking to staff, I felt perhaps a different and maybe a at least as effective, if not more, approach would be just to open it up to the committee members as a general survey to come up with this result that you see in front of you. And additionally, rather than have staff then make a recommendation as to what's been submitted, rather have staff here present, as I think they're very effective in doing, and Zlatko just did, in providing any background or questions to the BCP recommendations in general and specifically. In years past and developed by Judge Earl, to give her credit, when most of us were in the room, we just put these up on the board and we started voting. We can't do that for a couple reasons. One, I think the chief would be upset if I just started writing on the back wall of council chambers as what these priorities are, and there's a lot of us that aren't in the room. So, candidly, my experience in the past is what happens when a lot of us are on the phone. The participation is different. And I'm hoping today we can accommodate those who could not be here by allowing for full discussion without, again, as I said, dictating the discussion. But to start the discussion and recognizing it's not in any order, the first one on the list is civil assessment revenue backfill. So I'm just going to work down these as we go. There's if we discount number six, the trial court trust fund base operations, because I think that's already been provided, but if anybody wants to discuss that, please feel free. But that's the approach today, in case you're wondering, is I'm just going to work down each of these concepts, open each one up for full discussion and comment, and then try to keep notes with the help of staff as we go, and then ultimately recognize this as an action item, come up with a recommendation from this committee to the council. The civil assessment backfill, civil assessment revenue backfill, I think takes a little bit of history as well, and recognizing, by the way, and I just misspoke, these go to judicial branch budget committee. So that's the slightly different process with BCPs now. They filter through JBBC, through the various advisory committees, we being one of them, but again, I think as the trial court budget advisory committee, it's a significant voice that they also use. But with that, the civil assessment revenues, Jake and I had a discussion yesterday, and I'm not trying in any way to prevent other people from talking, but I just want to start the discussion and turn to Jake because I think he has a perspective on this that encapsulates both one and also, at least from my perspective, all the way down to number 11, the MOE buyout. Jake?
Thanks, Judge. So for the rest of the committee, what I'm going to share here is a little bit of mostly is about a discussion that occurred last week at SEAC, so that I can pass on what ended up being a motion in, from SEAC to provide some information. And
Jake, I'm going to – I apologize. Just administratively, I'm going to interrupt you for just a minute. Mike Planet has joined us. He's in the room. And I've now told that who? Mr. Roddy and Judge Barton are dealing with evacuation issues in their courthouses, so they are no longer presently participating. They're working on it, but I think safety comes before committee. With that, Jake, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. So there was a very robust discussion about the current year, the budget year, so 17-18, but it does play into the BCP or how we want to frame the BCPs for 18-19. And one of those discussions related to civil assessments and really revenue backfill in general was this discussion of is that and should that be a BCP effort or really is revenue backfill a strategy, and that often we are getting ourselves tied up in some policy level discussions about whether it's driver's license holds or civil assessments, where a big portion of our concern is about ensuring we don't degrade the ability for courts to provide service through revenue loss, but that sometimes gets confused with us taking a position on the policy or sounding like we disagree with the dialogue about the policy changes. So one of the things that we talked about last week, and I've talked about with others, is that over the past couple years, both because of movement around the nation, because of the Not Just Ferguson report, because of the letter we all received that's being called the Dear Colleague letter from the Federal Department of Justice, from work that courts are doing with advocacy groups and others related to their traffic processes, we've been looking at due process and traffic cases and have been called on, and many, not all of us have, been looking at how are we handling traffic, or what do notices say. The council has obviously made a number of rule changes to make it clear for people what their options are in traffic cases and ability to pay. But a portion of that is also making sure we're avoiding the appearance of conflicts of interest as it relates to fine and fee revenue. And an area at SEAC that we really discussed and talked about is civil assessments. And that by their nature, civil assessments can give that appearance of a conflict of interest. And that what SEAC was suggesting and what we asked the JCC staff to, at least from CX perspective, to take forward, is an effort to move civil assessment revenue from coming back to the branch directly, and instead that revenue go to the general fund, and we work with the administration on finding an appropriate way to calculate an ongoing revenue, but a one-time adjustment to our general fund allocation that matches that revenue swap. So we would continue to get revenue ongoing, but it would no longer be directly tied to the civil assessment orders that are made because of that appearance that it provides to those participating in the process and others. So that was the discussion around civil assessments. I hope that makes sense. But really, the idea is that we are giving a perception out there that of course, we don't believe is the reality, but that doesn't matter. It is a perception, and to continue to have that out there, I think, hinders our efforts to discuss the revenue decline that's occurring because it gets tied up in this broader policy discussion. And it would be good for us to get back to having being a part of the policy discussion without having to worry about the revenue piece, and that the revenue backfill is really a financial nature of we need to make sure we're not losing, you know, degrading our services, but we can be part of the policy discussion without there being this perception that there's a mix, that, that the revenue is guiding our discussion on the policy. So I hope that makes sense. Sort of stop talking to see if there's questions about that or anything I can clarify from the SEAC discussion.
And just as a little bit of background, and I'm sorry to keep interrupting, but obviously the civil assessment issue is one that is critical and ongoing. So through FMS, the FMS subcommittee funding methodology subcommittee of this committee continues to grapple with the issue of civil assessments, maintenance of effort, and how that impacts our budget. And there's a small working group within that subcommittee to this committee that is really drilling down on that. So this is something we continue to look at. Jake, I truly appreciate your the way you present it. I don't think we can ignore the perspective that, in fact, there might be a conflict of interest here. But as we all know, many times perspectives are not supported by facts. And here we have to deal with the factual issue of the revenue stream. So with that, concerning the first one on the agenda, the civil assessment revenue backfill, comments?
This is Sherry. The reason when Jake raised this at the CEO meeting, SEAC meeting on Friday, I thought it was really very strategic. I thought it was a really good idea for a couple of reasons. One is the one that Jake mentioned. The other one that I think we have not done a very good job in doing, and that is making it clear that civil assessments have become part of our operating budgets. And by doing as Jake suggested, it dawned on me that if we start giving them back and then having the money backfilled, you know, start giving the money back and not keeping it and having it reallocated, when it starts to go down, it's clearer that it's part of our operational money. We haven't done a good job of tying how we have used that money to run our courts. And this would help us do that. So I thought it was a really good suggestion. I would strongly support that concept. I don't really know how you would structure it, Jake, for this group, but I do think it's something important that we should make it a high priority.
So, Jake, do you have – and you had a concept of actually trying to provide some more detail on this as far as an averaging of civil assessment revenue for a certain time period so we could, as best as possible, provide structure to this BCP.
Right, and I'm not sure, and I'd have to defer to the LACO on whether this is really a BCP or it's a strategy. I'm not sure there, but I do think, I guess my suggestion would be that we try and move forward with calculating what is the average civil assessment revenue that has been collected over the past 3 years and use that as our number to say, you know, you don't want to pick 1 year because there might be fluctuations for any number of reasons, and be working on, okay, that dollar amount is what we would ask to be our general fund allocation, and then civil assessment revenue would just go into the general fund. We would, you know, obviously continue to collect it as ordered, but we would no longer be tied to its, you know, increases, so be it that the general fund would benefit. But we could look at that over a three-year period and include in that the issue number 11 that's on the additional BCP items about the maintenance of effort buyout, that those two things go hand in hand, allows us to address that issue of the trial court trust fund really bearing $48 million of that MOE while also having this three-year calculation done. That money comes in. We then, as you said, Judge Conklin, I think have to figure out how does that then get allocated, and there's already a group talking about that or started thinking about that. That would seem to make sense that it would go there as a separate item for this group to deal with should it come to pass. But the initial one would be, what is that three-year average of civil assessments? How does the MOB buyout play into that? And then make that as a request to say, that's what we are asking to be a general fund contribution in exchange for us giving the revenue on civil assessments, which should be a wash, right? So it shouldn't, I'm not sure that requires a BCP, and I have to defer to the LACO on that.
So, Jake, this is Rebecca. So that subcommittee of the subcommittee of the subcommittee that's dealing
working
with...
Working group.
Working group, exactly. That's dealing with civil assessments did do some collection on those kind of numbers. Colin was able to put together some information for us, so we could revive that information and see what's missing in order to help facilitate that conversation.
It is a budget change, especially if you're basically shifting risk of the civil assessment and what direction it would be going in the future from the courts absorbing the change to the general fund. And so technically speaking, that's how that would be viewed.
So what of the approach, and I know Mike Planner wanted to be heard, I'm going to turn to him, but I also see the one aspect of this that it's essentially a swap. I mean, it's the trial courts, the civil assessments, we would then say, okay, legislature, it's turned back to you. You address this from a policy perspective any way you want to do it, but those dollars would then be provided back to the trial court, be it a three-year averaging or whatever it is. So quite candidly, our budget remains intact because I don't have numbers, but I think we would all be in agreement that if civil assessments go away, you break our backs. I'm trying not to be overly dramatic about this, but I think Sherry makes a valid point. This has become a critical funding source to the courts, and I don't think we can ignore that. So from a policy perspective, though, I'm wondering if we can present it both as a BCP and a policy, and the policy perspective is this is really a trade-off. I mean, these are existing dollars. We're just asking you that you account for the funding stream in a different way, and that would be a BCP to fill the hole. Mike, Planet?
I'll comment on a question. I was at the meeting last week and had some time to think about it and think and support the approach moving forward. My only question is a quibble over the years, and maybe Rebecca or some others know better, but if we use this year and last year, will those numbers have been skewed by the amnesty? And are they the best years to use? Or, my only question is what 3 years do we pick as kind of representative of to use in the process?
I think that's a really good point. And I would actually, shooting from the hip right now, I would probably recommend the last 3 years prior to amnesty.
This is Tanya, and I'd really support that because I think a number of courts have really been devastated in the last year in that particular area. And I think we need to have, if we're going to use this method, and I absolutely support it, I think we need to have data that is more representative of what the reality is, has been in the past.
I would suggest that we be strategic in the years we pick. We don't want it to appear disingenuous if we're bargaining with the DOF. So, I would rather not lose the idea over cherry-picking the years we use. So I think that we should probably, maybe the working group or someone could work with Zlotko or Zlotko's group could work on it, but I just don't want us to come across as being disingenuous with what we're trying to do.
Judge Conklin, this is David Yamasaki as well, and I agree with that approach. People know, certainly within the court circles, that there were significantly higher years, and we're in a different situation right now. We're in a different situation, certainly with the legislature. So, looking at the 3 years for better or worse, I think is most appropriate. But the other thing that I would add is the MOEs really, the inclusion of the MOE in this approach, I think is very, very important because many of the courts are providing the monies to pay for those MOEs directly from the civil assessments, and they're very much tied. It verifies or validates the importance of doing something with the civil assessment monies because, as I think Sherry mentioned, it has become a important source for our ability to function. And those MOEs have been placed in the laps of many courts, and that's the source of the funding virtually in every instance, I think maybe in all instances. So it is important, in my view, to include it kind of as a package when we present this to Department of Finance or whomever needs to assess whether this is something that they will support.
Okay, I'm turning next in the room to Judge Herman, and then I'm going to turn to John Wardlaw because I'm just reading his face. And I also want to give him the opportunity, in case anybody doesn't know John, to briefly introduce himself, though I think you all do. And then, so Judge Herman and then John.
Well, I think that last point is a great point. You know, what we also got that kind of falls within the same policy umbrella as the Hertzberg bill coming down the pike, with driver's licenses no longer being used as leverage relative to traffic cases. And I know this was part of the discussions at the SEAC and PJ meetings as well, that that's, again, coming down the pike is likely to be a significant similar kind of debt to the civil or a dent to the civil assessment. So in terms of developing the policy, coming from the policy down, I think that's terrific, and I think I think that's something that we should address. It's not on the list, but something we have to anticipate coming down the pike. Part of just again as a follow-up is part of what we can show, because these were mechanisms that were created by the governor and the legislature in order to shift funding of the courts away from the general fund, and to just point out what services that we can directly, that we provide, that are in danger if the civil assessments are significantly reduced. So the policy being tie the services, tie public service to the ask.
All right. John?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Wardlaw. A little bit about my background. I've recently joined the Judicial Council in December. Previous to that, I spent 25 years in the executive branch of government, and 10 of which were with the Department of Finance in making the decisions and making recommendations to what they call their capital office, their executive team, on things. And what I'm trying to figure out here is kind of what is that really, really compelling soundbite that we can come up with, because I think intuitively everyone understands that we need to be able to operate our courts, no question about that. But there isn't a real good understanding, I think, both in the legislature and in the executive branch, particularly finance, about what these decisions really mean to our courts and to the people of California. It's not resonating. And so I think when we are competing for general fund dollars, we need to understand that usually it's health and human services, it's our correction systems, it's our education that are first in line, and they have really compelling arguments. And so that's our primary competition for general fund dollars. And in the conversations I've been having over the last couple months, I've been looking for what is that thing that we can say, hey, justice is being compromised, and what it really means to a legislator who really cares about their voting public, and to the administration as far as administration defenders of the general fund. They have a zillion priorities that they're going to safeguard before we get to have an opportunity to knock on the door. And so we've got to come up with that winning strategy, and I've yet to see that. So I'll take a pause.
All right, Judge Herman.
Yeah, and that's much better put than I put it. I mean, really, kind of the core of this from the legislative and the gubernatorial perspective is there are people that are financially challenged in the driver's license area, the civil assessment area, et cetera. And so that group their needs need to be recognized. So I think the tie here, the soundbite here, is it's that same population that we provide tremendous service to, both as court users, both as litigants, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe that's the umbrella policy approach is, you know, look, you're in the one way you're giving on this end, but that takes away our ability to serve the same population.
So I get, and now we're all rephrasing what we're all rephrasing, but I think that's an interesting perspective to help people appreciate is, if this funding goes away, it hurts those who at this point, the perception is it hurts by. The perception right now is these people can least afford this, and we're obtaining the money from those that can least afford it.
Giving with one hand and taking.
Right. But if we take this money away, those who most need our services will not get those services. So it is the proverbial two-edged sword. I think there's also perhaps a voice to be heard here, and I don't want to take this discussion too far afield, but if we talk about traffic fees and fines, perhaps we could also look to even our counties and the impact. I mean, I pulled this off the internet with the help of staff last night, but if you look at fees and fines and where those go, state penalty assessments, county penalty assessments, court facility construction fund, DNA verification, EMS penalty assessment. So there are so many other entities that are impacted by this that provide those critical services to our constituents. But again, I don't want to get too far afield. I like the concept approach of coming up with a concept without drilling down. But Judge Heinrichs?
Sure. I don't want to get too big. I don't disagree with what's being said. I think that, though, it's a pretty complex advocacy piece that we need to really think of in comments that were just made. I would just say all those departments, Health and Human Services, Department of Corrections, a robust justice system interacts with them, and if it was better, we could do so in a positive way to really make change. I think it gets as basic as what's the purpose of a fine? Is it to punish a behavior that shouldn't be occurring, or is it income-producing for anyone? And I think historically the legislature and governor said it was going to be income-producing. We were going to give money back to jails and to law enforcement and to others, and plus the courts. But I think it keeps stacking on assessments and then civil assessments if you don't pay until you bury people, and then folks can't get out from under what's been done, which looks very draconian. So I think we need to say the courts don't even want to be in the collection business. We don't want to be in the deciding fine business as to all of those things that get it on. We don't manage jails. We don't manage prisons. And there should be a better way to address the whole issue of fines. But on the other side, if there's no consequence, if you don't have to come to court at all and there's no consequence, then why come to court? So I think that the legislature, as they move in that direction, need to understand that part of the reason why I think traffic, and it's just anecdotal, isn't the filings are up, is law enforcement thinks, why do I even cite somebody? It's going to be a waste of my time. They're going to set it for a trial. I'm going to have to show up, and then the court's going to give them a minimum fine anyway, or even if they fine them fully, it's going to get excused somewhere down the line. And so it's all interconnected, and so how we unwind it so that, one, it's clearly understandable, and at the end of the day, the courts are on top of the advocacy argument is really a challenge. I think we can do it, but I don't know how to phrase it in the current sort of state of affairs. And, what's the purpose of a civil assessment? Really, why do we want to have those? Should they even any money come to the court? If it's because people should pay their fines, then it shouldn't go away. At the same time, folks that can't pay should have some kind of way out that doesn't handicap them forever. And so, I have more questions than answers, but I think that if we can somehow harness all of that discussion to make it clear that a robust and fairly funded justice system would really interact in a positive way with all the state service providers, and that somehow the shift of fines or what it means to pay a fine is revamped, that we could come out all ahead. But, again, it's so complex that when you start the discussion, it's like where, the elephant in the room with, all the blind people. Someone's touching the ear, someone's touching the leg, and it looks different to everybody.
So, again, just reminding everybody, it is an action item, but today it's a concept item. So we could come up with the concept today of a BCP, civil assessment and civil assessment backfill and MOE buyout. It's as simple as that concept, but then refer it back to either Judicial Branch Budget Committee or further work through staff in this committee to refine the ultimate implementation of the concept. But as a general BCP concept, I think we're trying to get our arms around what today, and there's other ones we need to discuss. I don't mean to say there's not, but how this would be stated. And did I hear a voice on the phone?
Yeah, Judge, it's Jake. I just wanted to make a little bit of a point here, is that this conversation, as we started it with civil assessments, and as I was, to John's point, trying to start with what is really the narrative, we got ourselves right back caught up in the underlying policy of the overarching issue of traffic fines and fees, which, again, is why we have to address this perceived issue of civil assessment dollars coming back to the courts, because when we bring these up, we then end up in this very lengthy conversation about all the great things we need to talk about, which is fines and fees are, you know, are they the right amount? Are they doing what we want to do from a policy standpoint, or what the policymakers want to do, and then have us, you know, deal with those and be a part of that discussion. So I think it just raises the importance of us addressing the revenue separately and really making a focus on revenue as a separate issue from the policy that needs to happen around traffic, potentially traffic reform or more broadly criminal justice reform, and that our point here really needs to be that we believe there are, after looking at it through calls from advocacy groups, through the legislature putting attention on this area, through the Federal Department of Justice putting attention on this area, the Judicial Council putting attention, that we believe there are revenue sources that create the perception of a conflict of interest, both for those going through the process and in policymakers when we're trying to be part of the discussion. And so we need to work on just swapping that revenue for general fund revenue. And,
well put.
Otherwise, we're going to keep getting caught in this feeling of we can't move anywhere.
Right.
You know, and if that's a motion, I would actually second it. I don't know if – I agree with you. I don't think this necessarily – well, Zlatko says it's a BCP. It doesn't feel like a – I don't know how you do it, but I think that is a very strategic and well-thought-through approach, especially considering the direction that the Chief Justice is kind of helping us look towards and Senator Hirschberg and others. So if that's a motion, Jake, I would support it. I would second it.
So, Jake, was that a motion? And if so, please define it.
Yeah, I don't know that I said that as a motion. I guess the motion would be that
Well, let me suggest, as you're thinking about that, let me suggest this approach, because we have other BCP concepts on this list that I want to make sure everybody has a chance to discuss. So perhaps you could, and Cher, I understand your perspective as well, that there's one of the policy discussion and there's one of the BCP discussion, but as a BCP concept, it's listed as number one and number 11. And so rather than ask for a motion now to approve that as a BCP to be submitted to JBBC, is there any other discussion on this before we move to court-appointed dependency counsel as a BCP? And then what my proposal would be is we look at the top five there after we've had a discussion and as best we can come up with a one or two or maybe three of the ones we want to send to JBBC. Did you want to be heard, Mike? You're looking at me. Okay. All right. Sam?
Ms. Conklin? This is David.
Yes, David.
I have a question or a point of clarification based on your last remark. At the outset, when we were talking about this particular item, you made a point of maybe the courts have been submitting too many or something along that line. And I wanted to find out if anybody had any thoughts, yourself or Zlatko or whomever, as to what's the right number? What should we be putting our eggs in which basket, and how many should that be? If, in fact, there is a number, then maybe that can kind of tailor the discussion that we're having here. If there isn't a number, you know, then, you know, that's also important to know as well. So I just kind of tee that up with you and, you know, respond if that's something that is appropriate or not.
Okay, so Zlatko's here. He presented the background earlier about how our efforts have been received in the past, and those have generally involved how many BCP?
Most recently, the branch submitted 17. I think we had four, and they were for bits and pieces, you know, some critical, and some weren't even as we'd requested. But, you know, to say it's three or seven, well, there are multiple areas that will be presenting BCPs as a branch to the Department of Finance. And so this is one aspect of them. There's needs in the Supreme Court, Courts of Appeal, facilities. I think that that's part of sort of the charge and why the Branch Budget Committee was created, to look at that and with your input provide the strategy to the council. But I think it goes back to John's point, is that whatever it is that we submit, the story, the justification, the impacts are the key. And given that we have such a broad challenge in many different areas, I think focusing on those that we can really provide the sort of pointed, focused efforts would help them digest the message. Too many items sort of throwing everything in the kitchen sink, I think, does dilute some of our critical issues, and we really need to focus on building the best case in light of the fact that we've submitted some of these in some form or fashion over the last few years and not been very successful.
So, again, 17 clearly didn't work. We have before us on table number one what I'll describe as five, because six is the backfill that's already been, I believe, addressed. Table number two is of 11. One suggestion for this discussion today would be allow everybody to be heard, but ultimately recommend no more than three BCP concepts to JBBC from this list of 16, but a hierarchy of the table one being the ones we have received the most votes.
Judge Conklin, this is Sherry. Maybe this is not the right time, so stop me if it's not, but I know you were going to take them in order. I would suggest that we skip number two, because in my opinion, three, four, five, and to some degree six, all fit together. Really what we're talking about is funding to address inflationary increases, whether they're employee compensation or whether they're contract increases. And actually, it also relates to just operational needs because of our WAFM gap. And the reason I raise that is because how the money is allocated is not a BCP question. It's a Judicial Council question. So three and four are really the same thing. We're asking for additional money, but how we allocate it isn't something you would necessarily put in a BCP, because the Judicial Council makes that decision. So I would suggest that we talk about what's the best approach, considering John's comment and others, to seek additional operational money that would also include money that we need for cost increases, which would include employee compensation and any other inflationary cost increases. So that would be my suggestion.
So, okay. So as I understand what you're saying, for instance, three and four use the word discretionary. So that would be an increase in discretionary funding. Five doesn't use the word discretionary, and I guess we could have a discussion as to whether or not we could include that in discretionary funds, or whether or not if it was a BCP for employee compensation standing alone, that the courts would be required to commit to using it for that purpose. But I think your approach is a productive one. Also, please, we're not implying for anybody that's listening in on the public line that court-appointed dependency counsel is not likewise an important issue to discuss. So it would be for a BCP concept, the civil assessment, backfill revenue, MOE buyout, then discussing next, and we may stop this discussion a moment to allow people to grab lunch, but then discussing next discretionary funding and then court-appointed dependency counsel. And then if anybody wants to be heard on table two, any of those individual 11, to advocate for a BCP concept, obviously we'd do that. So that's the approach I propose. I know that everybody on the phone is looking at noon for lunch. Our lunch has arrived. I just want to try to do this expeditiously and efficiently, also recognizing that those now seven committee members that are present in the room, staff as well, also have travel plans. So I want to keep this efficient. So my proposal is, just to get to a proposal, that now we have those concepts in mind, that we break for lunch, that lunch break, however, be come back at 12:15. That gives us half an hour to grab food. We can go shorter if you want. Sam?
Judge, I apologize for interrupting. I know you're trying to move things along, but I didn't want to leave the civil assessment question.
Go ahead.
With
I had just a couple of thoughts on it. One is, you know, the overall discussion, if you step back and listen to it, you kind of see the direction things are going. But as to the issue of the civil assessments would go to the general fund, theoretically, and then an amount would come back to the courts, is that based on historic figures? Is that what our average is? Is that what we're connecting to?
Yeah, that, I think that's what the discussion was, and I'll allow Jake, and I think Sherry and Rebecca talked about that as well. That would be a concept that we'd have to flush out later, but it would be, if it is presented as a BCP, what would be the amount? And we'd have to look back at averaging to come up with that amount to figure out what that actually would
well,
total.
Well, on the averaging issue, I agree that you can't cherry-pick the years because that, you know, that really wouldn't get you anywhere. But I also agree that the amnesty has skewed it, and I would suggest that a five-year average might be better than a three-year average.
Okay. So, again, that's, I think, a factor we can talk about as we define further work down on the BCP policy that would have to, as we ultimately present it to the council, what's the amount and how do we get there? That's a valid concern. So I know it's a little cumbersome because we have so few people in the room and we're trying to work through with lunch, but I don't want to in any way stifle a discussion. If we keep it on the civil assessment MOE buyout BCP concept right now, what other comments or concerns do folks have? That my proposal would be we finish this discussion, we break, and we come back and just move down the list to court-appointed dependency counsel for the purpose of discussion. But I want to make sure.
This
go
is
ahead,
Liz.
Sherry.
Oh, go ahead.
No, that's. I'll wait for you, Judge.
Okay. Thanks, Sherry. Just listening to the overarching tone of this conversation concerns me because what we are really talking about is the way the funding of this separate branch of government has degenerated into a cumbersome combination of revenue streams that have just been thrown at us over the years, and not only has it become unreliable and fluctuating, but it's subject to political whimsy, as we're seeing right now with the Ferguson effect and so forth. As we talk about what Jake is suggesting, and I really support what he's suggesting, I think we need to take a long view and recognize that what we say now could be the foundation of a better way of funding the branch in the future, a dedicated fund or something, a dedicated percentage of the budget as a whole or something like that, that would retain discretion in the judicial branch without relying on the legislature's current method of funding us for specific purposes only and not taking care of the general needs of the branch. When we talk about replacing revenue streams like the civil assessments and the MOE or fines and fees, we have to be talking about it in terms of replacing it with a more suitable form of grant to the branch from the general fund budget. That's my two cents.
I think that's a very valid two cents, as you stated, and not to boil it down simply, but I think you're right. I think the policy behind this is a legislative decision, but we as a branch have to recognize the impact of any policy decision they make, and all we're asking is that those funds as they've come into this court, be recognized to be a critical funding source and therefore a funding source that remains in place. Their decision about the policy behind it, the impact upon their constituents is for them to resolve.
Correct.
John, did you want to be heard?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I'm not hearing anybody say that the civil assessment revenue backfill combined with the last item is something that you don't want to pursue, And so that seems to me like ripe for, we all have agreement on that for further development, is what I think I'm hearing from folks.
I think you've appropriately summarized it. So that will, I will just, and I've just written that down as at the end of this BCP discussion, we will then turn to a hierarchy or, for instance, selecting three of these, and the one that we have just discussed would be described as a BCP to address civil assessment, backfill, and MOE buyout. Really, how far we drill down into that is for a later day. Okay? So
and
does anybody want to be – go ahead. Go ahead, Sherry.
I'm sorry. I know you're breaking for lunch. I was just going to throw out something for John and Zlatko to ponder while you guys are eating sandwiches. And because John said something interesting. He said, someone up there said, we kind of need to think through our strategy. And when we do get to 3, 4, or 5, which I think are all basically the same thing, I'd like if you could quickly turn to page 7 and 8 on the materials. I'm wondering if this would be a piece of the strategy that we could, that would be helpful. And that is on page 7, on the memo, it says employee cost to the trial court, to the trial courts is $7.1 million for trial court employees' retirement and health benefit costs. When you go on page 8, for judicial entities at the state level, employee costs for retirement and health benefit costs, I was struck by the amount if you broke it down per employee. So those of you who know me, this will not surprise you that I kind of did the math, and it's significantly higher for the Court of Appeal and Judicial Council, Judicial Branch employees and the trial court employees. So it's got to include more, I would think, than the retirement and health benefit costs. It must also include the funding for salary increases. So I was just curious if there was a way where we could somehow use that strategy to help the trial courts get additional funding to assist their employees, because while I can use the Schedule 7A to get the trial court employee numbers, it is harder to get the Court of Appeal and Judicial Council. But if I did the math right, it is quite a bit higher per employee. So is that a strategy we could use?
Zlatko?
Yeah, let me just say that as far as that particular adjustment, it does reflect then that the cost to the employee to contribute to their OPEB was also part of that. So the net, the contribution to the state ends up then transferring to some extent to the OPEB contribution that the governor was asking for. So that contributes to the number being sort of disproportionately
higher per
different.
Employee.
Yeah.
But you know, the trial courts did that without extra funding.
No.
I just am saying when we're talking about strategies and we're talking about strategies. I just wanted to kind of point that out, if there was something there we could use.
Oh, yeah, and I think we have used or at least called out that as part of our prior strategies when we've talked about some of the COLA requests we've identified in our budget change proposals, the amounts that state employees got, if it was 2% 1 year, then 2.5% or a 4% increase. We've tried to identify parity with state employees. I think, though, if you recall, the little bit of a concern about that strategy and what it means for trial court employees parity funding-wise, but also then management-wise. So I think that was part of the concern last week that was expressed about making the absolute connection there.
Yeah, and this is John. I think we can certainly pull that together as a strategy. But, again, I'll go back to, is this where you want your power punch? I know that it's an important issue for this branch, but we are competing against the mental health services, the child welfare services, the education services, and those resonate. And while compelling and understandable that we need to pay our employees, we normally get the back-of-the-line treatment within the administration. So, I think if we're wanting to push that particular item, I would combine it in a a combined package with something else. I wouldn't recommend necessarily putting it as a standalone because it gets picked off very easily when it comes down to the final decisions when the legislators are saying, hey, I've got to fund child welfare. I've got to fund all these other things. It's an easy pick off. So I would combine it with something else if we want to go down that road.
And I remind everybody that the process is TICBAC has to then to take these to JBBC. So whatever, and I like the target approach or the sort of the punch approach of these are not going right to the council. These are going to JBBC to make the recommendation as to what goes to the council. So the more focused we can be, I think the more impactful we are. So what we're going to do is take 30, for those of you that are on the phone for planning purposes, we'll take 30 minutes for lunch, give everybody a time to grab something. Since we're going to eat at our desks in the room, I'm going to impose on you to do the same and eat at your desks, or possible. We start at 12:20. Just to stay on in order, we'll come back and start the discussion, court-appointed dependency council. And then, Sherry, I like your approach. So if folks are putting thoughts together, we then move from court-appointed dependency council to discretionary funding allocations, combining items 3, 4, and 5. And then any comments from table 2 as well. And I think we can easily get through that discussion by 2 o'clock, if not before 2 o'clock at the latest. But just so you know, we're done today at 2. We have to be considering travel arrangements and storms coming in. So enjoy your lunch, folks. We'll be back public online in 30 minutes. Thank you.
Okay. The host has left the meeting. So at this time, the meeting will come to an end. Thank you and goodbye.